On behalf of the New York State Cessation Center Collaborative, I would like to turn the call over now to Ms. Annie Beigel.
Oh, thank you, Liz. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Annie Beigel, Manager of Cessation Programs for the New York State Department of Health Tobacco Control Program. And on behalf of the New York State Cessation Center Collaborative, the New York State Smokers Quitline, I'd like to welcome you to today's conference call, How the Tobacco Industry Gets and Keeps Your Patients Hooked. Our featured speaker today is Dr. Michael Cummings, Chair of the Department of Health Behavior in the Division of Cancer Prevention and Population Sciences at Roswell Park Cancer Institute. As healthcare clinicians, many of you have probably asked yourself, how could my patients be smoking in this day and age when they know how bad it is for their health? Well, part of the answer to this question will be covered in today's presentation. And the collaborative work group thought that it is important for healthcare clinicians to understand how the tobacco industry lures new smokers and maintains current users. For today's call, we are pleased to offer continuing education hours, including CME, CEU, OASIS clock hours, and CRCE hours. To fulfill the requirements of continuing education credit, we are required to disclose the following. Dr. Cummings receives research support from the National Cancer Institute, the New York State Department of Health, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, the American Legacy Foundation, and the Flight Attendant Medical Research Foundation. He has received speaker fees from Georgetown University, Dartmouth University, John Hopkins University, Clearway, Minnesota, the Substance Abuse Prevention Research Program, the Ontario Ministry of Health, Novartis Corporation, and Pfizer Corporation. He's received payment for grant reviews from the National Cancer Institute, Flight Attendant Medical Research Institute, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and the Canadian Partnership Against Cancer. He's also received payment as a paid expert witness for plaintiffs in litigation against the tobacco industry. There are no commercial supporters of this activity. And to obtain continuing education credits, you need to follow the instructions on the course credit and evaluation forms, which are posted on the website. Please remember to receive credit. Your applications will not be accepted after January 15th. That's next Friday. So please submit your application for credit before next Friday. And now it's my pleasure to hand the call over to Dr. Michael Cummings. Dr. Cummings?
Thank you, Annie. It's a pleasure to be invited back to give you an update on this topic, which I did about a year ago. And it's very timely today because we now have new legislation that impacts regulation of tobacco products and tobacco product marketing with the passage of the FDA legislation and its signage into law back in June. And in fact, the topic is very timely as of today because I opened up the Wall Street Journal this morning and there's actually an article talking about Philip Morris pushing smokeless tobacco and specifically highlights some of their comments submitted to the FDA to try to position smokeless tobacco as a safer alternative to cigarettes. And that's an interesting issue to follow as to how the FDA will respond to that, and certainly raises questions, I think, in terms of how the typical consumer out there is responding to all the information that is available on the issue of tobacco. So in this new year, now we're, you know, six decades from essentially the Surgeon General's report in 1964, we have an array of new products. There are over 1,800 different cigarettes and cigarette line extensions, and then an array of smokeless products, cigars. We have e-cigarettes. We have tobacco tablets, strips, and sticks, and it's a rather confusing topic. But there are some consistencies that I think that you'll see run through almost all of the tobacco products that manufacturers are producing. I'm going to try to describe some of those today. And so my objectives today, and with the slides, that hopefully people have in front of them or can follow through, that have been posted online, you'll see that I have basically two simple objectives to try to cover today. One is to recognize how tobacco industry marketing influences people to start and keep smoking. And when I talk about marketing, there really are four areas or four aspects of marketing to think about. And today we'll talk about one of those aspects in a fair amount of detail. But the four P's of marketing, and this applies to all products, be it cigarettes, Coke, or, you know, selling milk or cereal. The first P is product. Cigarette companies start with designing products to meet the needs, wants, and desires of different target audiences, and of course, the goal is to make a lot of money. But product is really the focus, and that will be what I'll spend most of my time talking about today. Price is a big part of marketing as well. We see this certainly in New York with the availability of discount cigarettes and, of course, low and on-tax cigarettes that have dominated, it, particularly in certain regions of the state, people's smoking behavior and the brands that they're selecting and where they purchase from. Promotional activities, which is the marketing, primarily at the point of sale, often coordinated with price discounts that are done with retailers, and then placement, where the products are actually placed, where the advertising is placed, and that obviously has an impact on who the target audience is. So we'll keep those four P's in mind as I go through the rest of my presentation today. The next objective, of course, is to describe how you as healthcare clinicians can incorporate some of this knowledge into the interventions that you use with the clients that you see on a daily basis. Some of you deal with individual patients. Some of you deal with groups because you might be involved in running quit smoking classes or doing presentations to community groups, and perhaps others on this call are involved in doing more public presentations, even talks to school children and so on. I think you'll find the information that we'll cover here today of value to you, and hopefully I encourage you to use the slides that I've prepared here to assist you with the presentations that you might use. But you can ask the basic simple goal, what is the goal of product design? And, you know, it's very simple. If you go to the next slide, the answer is money, money, and more money. The business of the tobacco companies is very simple, is to maximize their profits. This is a, you know, fortunately, when you look at the trend, cigarette consumption and tobacco consumption in general is dropping dramatically in the United States and has been for a number of years, thanks in large measures to you all and others who've been advocating for people to be better informed about the health risks of smoking, as well as policies that appropriately discourage the use of these products. But the money issue is a problem because this is a massively profitable product. It costs about a quarter of a cent to make a single cigarette that they put in a box. If you have 20 cigarettes in a box, that's typically a day's supply of nicotine. That works out to a nickel a pack, folks. And if you're making smokeless tobacco, one of the reasons the companies are so enthralled with this is because they even use less tobacco. It costs them less money to produce the product that they actually sell there. In fact, the companies spend about 3 to 4 times as much on the marketing of that product, the price promotions, the product placements, the deals with retailers and so on, the couponing that goes on, the payment for the extensive websites that they have. That's not included in the 5 cent cost of a pack of cigarettes. The 5 cents refers to the manufacturing cost for that product. But it's enormously profitable, which is why as cigarette consumption has gone down over the past year, particularly because of the federal tax increase on cigarettes, we have actually seen cigarette company stocks go up. And one might ask, well, how can your stock price go up as consumption is dropping? You're selling less of it, and the answer is simply the companies are passing the costs along, and they're just charging more. So that gets to the next question, why do people smoke? And it's interesting to see what the industry has said about this. So if you go to the next series of slides that I have, beginning in 1953, this is from a famous Fording memo that was written by an executive at Hill & Knowlton, who had met with some of the research directors of the tobacco industry to help them as their effort to try to counteract and respond to some of the emerging information about the health risks of smoking. And they hired Hill and Knowlton to create a public relations campaign for them. But it's insightful and to see what some of the research directors at the company said. And you'll see this one comment that's been highlighted here. One of the men said, this is a research director at a major cigarette manufacturer in the United States, said it's fortunate for us that cigarettes are a habit that they can't break, of course, referring to their consumers. If you just fast forward to 1963, another internal memo, this one written by the chief general counsel of Brown and Williamson. He was also, by the way, involved with the executive committee, the oversight committee for the Council for Tobacco Research, or in this case, the Tobacco Industry Research Committee in 1963, Addison Yeaman. And what he says is, moreover, nicotine is addictive. We are in the business of selling nicotine, an addictive drug. And then, of course, they go on to talk about what they anticipate the Surgeon General is going to be saying in a short period of time. Surgeon General's report, of course, came out in January of 1964, so a few months later. And what they knew was that the committee would be claiming that smoking caused lung cancer, cardiovascular disease, and emphysema. Those were referred to as unattractive side effects. We go to the next slide. We just move ahead, and this one is particularly interesting. It's a Philip Morris memorandum in 1969, actually not a memorandum, a speech that was given to the board of directors of the Philip Morris Corporation by their research director, Helmut Wakeham. And he described to them in 1969 this psychology research program that Philip Morris had launched. And the focus of the program asked two simple questions. Well, asked the question, why do people smoke? And they said, in order to understand this, we need to understand why does one begin to smoke, and then why does one continue to smoke? And that was quite insightful, because they acknowledge what we know today is that most people begin their smoking careers during their teenage years, 16 to 20-year-olds, as they say, typically begin smoking for psychosocial reasons. In other words, their friends are doing it to become more adult-like and so on, to enhance their image in the eyes of their peers and so on. But as they also go on to point out, why do people continue to smoke? Well, that's not explained by why they start. They continue to smoke, and they indicate here just a few pages further on in this presentation to the board of directors, the ultimate explanation for the perpetuated cigarette habit resides in the pharmacologic effect of smoke upon the body of the smoker. And in 1972, the director of that psychology program, Dr. William Dunn, wrote in a speech that he gave to research scientists as part of the CARESTA group, which is largely populated by industry scientists who were involved in their research and development program. No one has ever become a cigarette smoker by smoking cigarettes without nicotine, and that's true. So why they lied? You go fast forward to 1994, all the tobacco chiefs said cigarettes aren't addictive. They continued that lie, by the way, up until October of 2000. Philip Morris finally came around and acknowledged that cigarettes might be addictive. Liggett and Myers, now known as Vector Tobacco, you know, as the master settlement was being debated and so on, they actually acknowledged that cigarettes were addictive in 1997, going against the grain of the other manufacturers. But why they lied is very simple. And if you go to this next document, here's an internal document from the Tobacco Institute in 1980, and they're talking about a conference that had gone on at NIDA where they were beginning to talk about the fact that cigarettes should be thought of as addictive product, and that nicotine specifically was the addictive component of cigarettes. And what they indicated is in this memo is we can't defend continued smoking as free choice if the person was addicted. So I've been involved in doing smoking cessation for almost 30 years, and it's pretty common for smokers to beat themselves up over the fact that they tried to quit and they failed many times. Cigarette smoking is a chronic relapsing problem for the majority of individuals. They have to have many trials of quitting before they finally can be successful in staying away from cigarettes for an extended period. Some people continue this process until it becomes so evident they have to quit for reasons that they thought would never happen to them. They've had a heart attack. they've been told they have emphysema and they can't breathe very well, or, you know, God forbid, they end up in a place like Roswell Park and, you know, the doctor is telling them that they hate to tell them that they have lung cancer. It's amazing how that, you know, alters motivation. So people think, well, all you have to do is be motivated to quit. And of course, you have to be motivated to want to quit smoking in order to do it. But my experience is almost all smokers want to quit. Over 90% of smokers surveyed in the United States, in Canada, Australia, and the United Kingdom say they regret their decision ever to start. If you follow a group of smokers over time, almost all smokers will tell you that they've thought about quitting, they've tried to alter their smoking patterns. The most addicted smokers often don't make it 24 hours, which is somewhat of an arbitrary criteria for measuring a quit attempt, because if you're really addicted, it's hard to even make it 24 hours to quit. So if you go to the next slide, you know, just pointing out here, you can talk about choice as the cigarette companies are often talking about, well, it's a personal responsibility and it's free choice. But really, because of the way they design their product, this product is engineered to constrain a choice of the smoker once they've gone through that first initial step, typically as a teenager, to put the cigarettes to their lip or put the pinch between their cheek and gum. And in a large number of individuals, about 80 to 90%, they become daily users of these products, and that's the sign that they're addicted, that their brain has been altered in a way that's going to make it hard for them to quit, and their choice is now constrained. So the product design is all about one thing, nicotine. As you can see, this is a picture of a lovely tobacco plant, and it's all about the money because that translates into that quarter cent a stick, 5 cents a pack, and so on. So I'm going to take you down the trail of helping you understand how they design some of these products to control the nicotine delivery, to keep their people magically going to the store, plunking down their money, even going out of the way to travel to Indian reservations or go online and use credit cards to buy their cigarettes, even though most adult smokers today can't really give you a good reason why they continue to smoke. Most, in fact, say they wish they could quit. So there are three critical features in the design of tobacco products, and I'll focus a lot on cigarettes because that's the predominant product and it's probably the most lethal and highly addictive of the products because the smoke is in an aerosolized form and the nicotine on the tar particles is delivered into the lungs, a large surface area, and the nicotine literally is absorbed into the bloodstream and is hitting the brain within about 7 to 10 seconds. By contrast, a lousy nicotine delivery system like a nicotine band-aid or a patch requires about 2 hours for the nicotine to be absorbed through the skin into the bloodstream to, again, to affect the brain in a way that will alleviate some of the nicotine withdrawal, the irritability, the problems controlling emotions, the cravings that people have. These are really the absence of nicotine to the system that particularly the most heavily addicted smokers tend to experience. So in designing a tobacco product, you really need to think about three things. The blend of the tobacco that you use, because different tobaccos and different manufacturing types of material that you use in making a tobacco product contain different amounts of nicotine. And cigarette companies are very expert at figuring out how to put together the right blend in order to influence the nicotine delivery. Secondly, is additives. And there are lots of additives in cigarettes, and there's lots of descriptions of additives. The companies often talk about them as flavoring agents and so on, but the additives are there in most cases to affect the ability of the individual to smoke the cigarette, making it more palatable, to inhale the smoke deeply into the lungs, to rapidly deliver that nicotine, and or to potentiate the effect of nicotine, and I'll give you some examples there. And finally, there's the engineering of the product. The product is not a natural one. Tobacco leaves don't get normally chopped up and rolled in a piece of paper and smoked. They have a filter added to it. There's all kinds of engineering that goes into the design of the filter and the paper, and there's a lot of, if you look at the patents that are coming out on cigarettes today, most of the evidence or almost all of the new work going on in product design is in the area of flavoring in the products, particularly in the filter. So let's go to the next slide that talks about tobacco blending. And this is just a slide that depicts for you that different strains of tobacco have different amounts of nicotine. And so you have bright tobacco, which tends to be tobacco that's what they call flue-cured. In other words, they put it in barns and they use, they used to use wood. Now they tend to use propane heating and they let the tobacco leaves dry out and they use the wood to burn or the propane fires that are in the barns during this drying process to speed up the curing of the product. It does change the chemical nature of the product. It also ages it more rapidly. A lot of the bright tobacco is grown in places like Virginia, Maryland, and it tends to have a little less nicotine in it than burley tobacco. Burley tobacco tends to be air cured. This is perhaps you've seen tobacco farms if you've driven down south or into Kentucky where the tobacco is hung out in a barn, but it's drying in the air, not enclosed in a barn with heat around it. It's allowing the air and the sun to dry out the tobacco, and that's burley, and that tends to have a higher concentration of nicotine. And then you can also look at oriental tobacco, which is not used as much in U.S. cigarettes, about 10 to 15%. That has the lowest amount of nicotine. And then you have things like the stems and the paper, Recon and Bandcast. Those are two types of manufactured or man-made tobacco. A lot of people are not aware that the cigarettes that are sitting on the shelf are recycled and reused. The tobacco is taken out and the companies reuse it to make reconstituted tobacco. So if you turn to the next slide, what's in a cigarette? This is actually showing you roughly the approximate amounts of bright, burley, stem, oriental, and recon. It's interesting to note that if you go to Canada, for example, or Australia or other parts of the world, almost all of the tobacco used in their cigarettes is bright tobacco. The U.S. blend, which you probably heard about, is this combination of different tobaccos that are blended together. Over time, there's been less tobacco put in the tobacco rod, actually wrapped up in that piece of paper there. So the weight of tobacco has actually gone down over time. And that's been done to try to reduce the tar yields. But the companies knew they had to maintain a certain amount of nicotine. So over time, they've switched from using more bright to more burley tobacco. And also using reconstituted tobacco, this man-made stuff that's recycled. They also chop up the stems and so on. They extract all the nicotine. They call the extracted material the rich brown liquor. They spray it back onto the sheet that they have now created in a uniform dose. You look at discounted cigarettes, you'll often see that they have little white specks. That's just poor quality control. They haven't sprayed the coloring agent back on it, but it includes the nicotine and the coloring. It's man-made. It's produced using the same process that you use in making a piece of paper, and they can control the amount of nicotine in part by the use of reconstituted tobacco. So the blend makes a big difference. And in fact, if you go to the next slide, this explains exactly what the goal is. And it's to maintain, to reduce the tar levels, which we're all in favor of, you know, taking out the tar because the tar's got lots of lousy chemicals in it that we know cause a variety of diseases, including cancer. Over 4,000 chemicals in every puff on a cigarette. But the bottom line is the minimum amount of nicotine is needed to keep the smoker smoking. And so the companies engineer their product to make sure that the smoker can extract enough nicotine out of it to satisfy their body's daily need of nicotine. And there are a variety of ways that they do this. Blending is one of them, the reconstituted tobacco. But if you go to the next slide, there's some engineering tricks that are used in cigarettes, filtration, filter ventilation, permeable paper, the paper that they wrap around the tobacco rod or column, is often varies in the permeability or porosity, as they call it. In other words, they laser little holes so light and ultralight cigarettes tend to have more porous paper. They have higher ventilation rates. They have filters that are designed to be a little less efficient. You can also influence through product engineering things by just making the cigarette a little bit longer or a little bit wider or a little bit narrower. So I've given you examples here of, you know, back in the late 1960s, early 70s, Benson & Hedges was promoting the fact you get extra puffs on a cigarette because of their longer size. The wider and smoother flavors of Camel Wides, and of course now we have the Super Slim, Ultra Slim cigarettes from Virginia Slims. This is a growing segment of the market. And these all impact the delivery of nicotine to the smoker. Let's talk about filters to start with, because this has been one of the biggest frauds that the companies have ever come up with, is the putting a filter on the cigarette and giving the illusion that somehow a filter makes the cigarette a little safer. This is not true. It may have somehow reduced a little bit of the tar, but it also introduced smokers to something that they're probably not aware of, which is filter fiber fallout. Now, you can say that five times fast, as you can see from this particular ad, but this is actually a real picture of a Marlboro, a regular Marlboro cigarette under a high-powered electron microscope, which you need to have in a microscope to see this, but the little tiny cellulose acetate plastic shoe polish white color painted filter fibers are dangling right off the end. And if you do the little tongue test and you touch it to your tongue and I put some scotch tape on your tongue, some of these fibers will come off every time you put a cigarette in your mouth. So don't do that, by the way, because you don't want to be ingesting plastic fibers into your lung. One of the problems with this is, of course, smokers are doing this usually 10 to 12 times. They're putting the cigarette in their mouth to puff on it for every cigarette, 20 cigarettes a day, 365 days a year. It's not surprising that a few of these tiny microscopic fibers break off and end up right into the lung. And this is a filter fiber you can see in the little box there on the filter, now coated with the carcinogenic tar, inhaled into the lungs. And your lungs don't like plastic material. They have a sort of an immunologic response to that material, and they begin to generate more macrophages in the lungs, which is a cell that's basically going to cause a little inflammation because it's hard to digest the cellulose acetate fibers, these plastic fibers. And so you thought a filter was safer, think again. Filter fiber fallout, not my word. That's the word from the Philip Morris back in the late 1950s. That's what they talked about monitoring with the introduction of filters on cigarettes. The biggest design feature of a cigarette filter, however, that really causes problems in terms of nicotine delivery and this fraud of light cigarettes is filter ventilation. So if you go to the next slide, it's probably the most influential design feature of the modern cigarette, because by putting these little invisible vent holes in the filter tip, they allow the smoker to take a bigger, deeper puff on the cigarette by reducing resistance to draw. It just makes it easier to take a bigger puff on the cigarette. So if you switch from a regular to a light or a light to an ultralight cigarette, or even if you stay within the light categories and the companies, without telling you, will change the amount of filter ventilation as they've done over the years in their cigarettes, you just are able to take a bigger, deeper puff of that smoke. And while the cigarette on a smoking machine may appear to give you a certain value of tar and nicotine, it has no relationship to what you're going to be getting in the actual amount of nicotine going into your body, which is what counts. We know that when the cigarette companies, by the way, have been mandated in places like the European Union to set maximum levels for tar and nicotine in the product, all they've done is they've not changed their product in any other way but altered the filter ventilation. And, of course, this doesn't change at all the amount of nicotine that we actually end up measuring in people's urine or in their bloodstream. And, of course, they end up getting all, that's just a proxy measure for all the other things that they're going to smoke. If you go to the next slide, this is showing you one of the problems with filter ventilations. The location of the filter vent holes escape a blockage on a smoking machine. That's why the FTC, the the Federal Trade Commission, which used to mandate testing of cigarettes, dropped that mandate a few years ago, or dropped the reporting. I think the mandate is still required. The companies have to provide that information to them, but they don't give it to the public anymore because they know it's so misleading. The tar and nicotine numbers that are produced on packs put in advertisements have nothing to do with the amount of tar and nicotine a smoker is likely to get. And because the machine vent holes are unblocked, you can see just smoking this cigarette the way you put it in your mouth or cover it with your fingers can actually block the vent holes. Here's this next ad that talks about filter ventilation. This is actually from a trade publication that for tobacco manufacturers, and it's saying we can give you cigarettes where the filter vents are visible or invisible. And I'll just have you do a little quiz here. Which one has the cigarette companies chosen to use in the cigarettes? You can ask smokers, because if you go to the next slide, you'll find the illusion of light is they've chosen to make them invisible and hard to see. Almost all light cigarettes and ultralight cigarettes use white tipping paper. That's the little paper band that goes around the filter tip end, and they have these little vent holes there, and they're impossible to see. And this gives you a little example of how you can show somebody to take the little tipping paper off, get a little flashlight underneath, and then magically the filter vents appear. And the next slide is just showing you that if you block the filters either 50% or 100%, it nearly gives you a tenfold increase in the amount of tar and nicotine somebody would likely get from that product. So the numbers that we currently get from the companies on tar and nicotine testing, according to the Federal Trade Commission method, is completely bogus. So using the word light, ultralight, low tar, just meaningless hooey, and in fact will be banned shortly by the FDA legislation. The next slide just shows you in the urine of a smoker, the amount of a carcinogen in smokers of regular light and ultralight. It's just, again, summarizing the fact there's no difference in the amount that you see in people smoking these different brands. So many smokers tell me that they've switched to a light or ultralight cigarette in hopes that they would use this as a cut-down method to help them quit, and this does not work, because they don't cut down any of what they're going to get in the smoke. The only way to cut down is to not smoke the cigarette at all. And it's useful to have that information. Now, if you go to the next slide, we talk about additives. Tobacco includes a variety of additives, over 500 different additives that are used, and I've described different kinds of additives, casings that are put on the product, humicants, which are designed to keep the tobacco moist so it has a little longer shelf life, flavoring agents, pH controllers like urea and diammonium phosphate. So, you know, they talk about them like Newports, but we should call them Newpees because they add urea to the product to potentiate the delivery of nicotine. That's what pH controllers tend to do. The companies talk about them making the smoke milder and smoother, so when you see those kinds of labels, you're talking about using pH controllers there, and it does have that effect. Really dumb to put an additive in a lethal product that's going to make it easier to inhale. Just think of what all these kinds of things that they've done. If you really want to make cigarettes safer, you would probably go to a single blend, no additives whatsoever, and a filter, if you're going to put one on at all, probably would have no filter ventilation whatsoever. The paper has burn rate controllers. It has inks. These things, by the way, when they're burned, because the companies often talk about, well, their additives are already accepted as safe by the FDA under what they call the GRAS list of the generally regarded as safe, but those things are regarded as safe as unburned food additives. In other words, something you would ingest, not burn and then ingest, as you do with cigarettes. So the burning process changes a lot of these things and actually converts some of them into pretty dangerous chemical exposures. And of course, the filter now, we see a lot of flavoring agents like Camel Crush and so on. The next slide is actually, I took right off of the Philip Morris website, and a lot of the companies are now doing this. You can actually go on the websites and they'll describe for you some of the additives that they put in a cigarette. So this is one for Marlboro Regular Box. and, you know, just talking about it. And these are their terms of the purpose of the additives, you know, moisturizing agent or flavoring, humigant, and so on. These are, you know, cocoa. It sounds pretty innocuous. We're all familiar with having a little cocoa this time of year, hot chocolate and so on. But, you know, they talk about it as flavor. Well, you burn cocoa, it actually is a bronchodilator. It actually has some pretty harmful effects when it's burned, just as an example. And hopefully with the FDA, we'll learn a lot more about the purpose of these additives and encourage the dangerous ones to be removed, likely all. The flavored tobaccos, as you go to the next slide, this is just showing you that, you know, every week you see these new products coming out all over the world, basically, flavored cigarettes. And so the United States is not the only market out there, but you can see all kinds of things with strawberry and raspberry, cherry, clove. And a lot of people were confused when the FDA this September said, well, you can't, you know, have the flavors in cigarettes. Well, all the FDA law says you can't have them as characterizing the product. So the labeling of the product, you can't talk about vanilla Camels anymore. You can't talk about menthol Camels because there was an exclusion in the FDA bill regarding menthol as one of the flavoring agents. But that's not telling you about whether these flavors are actually in the product. And almost all the products have flavoring agents designed to mask the harsh, irritating, lousy taste of the product, particularly smokeless tobacco products where you don't have them burn. A lot of the taste in a burned, combusted product like cigarettes comes from the actual burned part of the product or the tar. That's where you get most of the taste. But if you just go through a couple of products here, in the next slide, I'm just going to quickly go through a few of these. This is right from the Philip Morris speech that was given by the head of Philip Morris International recently, Mr. Camilleri, where he talked about expanding Philip Morris's market and the ways they were going to do this were through enhanced consumer understanding and innovation. So you can see the variety of new flavorings, a 1 milligram Marlboro that's being marketed in certain parts of the world, and Blue Fresh. If you go to the next page, you'll see the variety of line extensions of just one single line of Marlboros, the Marlboro Reds. There are over 40 varieties of Marlboro currently sold in the U.S. market, and worldwide it's an even larger number. If you go to the next slide, you can see, you know, Silver Mint, and then their Ice Express, again, going into the menthol area. They're trying to really compete with the other companies such as you know, Reynolds American Tobacco, which manufactures Salem and Cool Cigarettes, and Philip Morris is aimed at trying to go after them. And, of course, you're all familiar with Camel Crush, which was the Camel Light cigarette that magically converts into a menthol version, and they have been using Cool Boost. Cool Boost is a menthol cigarette, but they've added a little pellet in the filter, and when you crush the little pellet, you get an extra boost of menthol, just sort of like the chewing gum burst that you can get now when you chew on a piece of gum, and you get that extra burst of flavor that they built in it. And this is just showing you in the next slide the Camel Crush pellet that is in the filter tip of the Camel Crush that came out about a year ago. Very successful product. Talked to a lot of young people that got hooked into starting with Camel Crush. Clearly a starter product for those kids who don't know whether they want to smoke menthol or regular, or want to be able to share their cigarettes with their friends. You can see the marketing of the Cool Boost here. This is in Japan. They, you know, even give you instructions on how to use it in a cool little device here to encourage you to buy it. They have their smokeless variety as well. So some of the additives, if you go to the next one, this is just talking about the various flavoring additives, and these are not necessarily safe, as the National Toxicology Program has found for one of the additives that's currently used in cigarettes. It's highly carcinogenic when burned. And the next slide is a 1963 internal memo from Helmut Wakeham, the director of research at Philip Morris, that acknowledged that they couldn't really use the GRAS list, generally regarded as safe list for foods, for cigarettes, because cigarettes are burned and foods are ingested, and it's a whole different ballgame. So pH modifiers. The next slide just talks about the use of ammonia and diammonia phosphate. This is actually from a Brownham Williamson internal blending report looking at the purpose of these additives to reduce irritation. Smoke ammonia reactions enhances nicotine availability or freebasing of nicotine, referred to as free nicotine. It enhances some of the flavoring in the product, you know, making it more palatable. And actually, the success of Marlboro Red cigarettes back in the early 1960s, and if you look at the sales trends for that product, largely stems back to the fact that Philip Morris was one of the first in the industry to add diammonia phosphate to its reconstituted tobacco to alter blend chemistry to give it its stronger taste profile, making it smoother and easier to smoke and giving you a little bit more nicotine kick. And that was all very positive. And then they came up with the Marlboro Cowboy. So actually, the product design issues, the product changes, part of that marketing mix is key to understanding the success of different brands. So what do you tell your patients about all of this? Well, 4,000 chemicals in every cigarette, a pee in every puff. You have to have some ways for them to understand. But most people, if you just sort of put it in context, you know, this is a lethal, addictive substance. Why would you want to make it taste better? And you begin to understand how they engineer the product to keep you hooked. That's what it's all about. Of course, smokers believe that lights mean safer, as you can see in the next slide. Which one is the fraud, of course, is the Marlboro Lights, because the other Philip Morris products or Altria products, you know, are all actually giving you less calories, but Marlboro does not give you less tar, less nicotine, or less cancer if it's in their light or ultralight. Now, a lot of countries, over 40 around the world, have actually banned light, mild, and low tar, so we sort of know what's going to happen in this country, and some of us have already looked at this in different parts of the world, and deceptive labeling and pack design is what we're going to see. In fact, you can see how the companies, even when they take off the words light and ultralight, they use their colors as a way of marketing the product to give it a cleaner, healthier association, the smaller chevron, the lighter color, and so on. So colors make a big difference, and already R.J. Reynolds and Philip Morris are taking the light, ultralight descriptors off and are switching to the color coding to educate their consumers. In the United Kingdom, when they did this, by the way, they actually gave instructions to retailers so they could educate their smokers about what the new brand labeling would be so they wouldn't be confused about which products to choose. So as you can see from this little cartoon, these new regulations will fundamentally change the way they get around them. That's what the cigarette companies are interested in, because they need to make a lot of money. Replacement descriptors here in Canada, when they went from ultralight, they went to ultra smooth. They just changed the word light to smooth. And you can see, you know, here in Poland, Philip Morris International is even touting this in their speech to their stockholders, talking about how they've come up with a new lineup to address, again, the European Union's elimination of the terms light, low tar, mild, and so on, with a color coding system for L&M. So we've actually done a study here, and just show you real quick the results. We showed a group of smokers in a shopping mall, basically two packs of a cigarette, one labeled full flavor, one labeled smooth, and we asked them which one had more tar, smoother taste, which one would you buy, which one would reduce your risk of health. And you can see clearly the words do make a difference. And here's the next slide is looking at full flavor versus silver, same kind of response. You can use the numbering. This is what happened in Europe when they took the labels light and ultralight off the packs. The companies came up with a description of numbers, 10 and 6. The numbers are meaningless, but consumers assume that the lower number meant you were getting smoother taste and lower risk, which is, there's no difference. So this is a fraud. And you can even look at how they shade the packs here. So here's one that's a little darker and a little lighter shading. People interpret the lighter shading as, you know, being safer. And so, you know, if you wanted to sort of get to what the logical conclusion is the colors really do make a difference, and plain packaging is probably what we need to be going towards. Unfortunately, there was a decision issued yesterday regarding the FDA legislation where the judge in the case apparently was confused about this issue about the importance of colors to the pack. The industry argues the colors are part of their branding and important to First Amendment. So this is likely to be played out in the courts over the next year or so. But we can see what the effects are having on your patients already. So you want to know what's going on out there? There are new products being introduced every day. And there's a website I wanted to tell you about called www.tobaccoproducts.org actually we keep track of new products that are coming on the market all over the world. There are new patents you can get and read, advertising. Now with YouTube and some of the international marketing going on, you can get all kinds of examples, some of the marketing of the different products. Here's just a sampling of some of them, but I'd encourage you to take a look at this website if you want to learn more about tobacco products and what's being introduced, including things like the new e-cigarette. Just a real quick highlight of, I think, some things to put on the radar screen. We've already seen the Virginia Slims, Super Slims, but we're not the first place to see this. In fact, in parts of Europe and Southeast Asia, they've been heavily marketing these super, super thin, almost like toothpick thin, Super Slim cigarettes. Young people automatically assume that these products, because of the slim design, are safer and contain less tobacco and are less addictive. Not true. Big tobacco in the smokeless game, as you can see from the next slide, and that started about 3 or 4 years ago with Reynolds introducing Camel Snus, and then Philip Morris with Tobacco, and now Marlboro Snus. They've all now purchased different smokeless tobacco companies. Reynolds bought Conway, and Philip Morris last year bought United States Tobacco, which makes Copenhagen and Skoll. And they're now positioning this as a way to have a continuum of risk, as they say, to try to fit into the FDA rules. So why so many new products and why smokeless? Just real quickly, I said this is nothing new. If you actually go back to a Reynolds internal document in 1982, they said, you know, we can't really be comfortable selling a product which most of our consumers would stop using if they could. Of course, they were talking about cigarettes at that time. And in fact, if people could stop smoking easily, you know, they would leave. They would stop almost overnight and they'd be out of business. So what are the options? Go out of business? Find a way to eliminate the desire of smokers to stop smoking, or perhaps provide other products away from conventional cigarettes? Well, if you go to the next page, they go on to say, you know, element number one is unacceptable and number two is not achievable, then the only option they have is to come up with these alternative products, and I think that's what you're seeing here. So they've been thinking about this problem, and smokeless products have been on the agenda for a while. And why smokeless? Well, we've seen the denormalization of smoking in public venues, particularly because of our clean indoor air laws. They need to maintain an addiction in a changing environment. They're looking at it as a gateway because, of course, the strategy of any successful product for tobacco companies is hook 'em young, hook 'em for a life. And smokeless products are ease of use, deter cessation. You can use it in places where we now restrict smoking. They're going to tout health advantages about the product. And in fact, it's very unlikely that smokers will go completely to these products for safer purposes. More likely you're going to get dual use, and they know it. So the next product just talks about the fact there are lots of different smokeless products out there, all in a variety of different flavoring agents. Flavoring agents should be banned. Now, the characterizing flavors, unfortunately, only affected cigarettes in the initial rules from the FDA. There are a wide variety of smokeless tobacco products, from the moist snuff to snus to tablets and strips and sticks. You've got big wads of tobacco or chewing tobacco. You've got rolling tobacco. Talking about the moist snuff products is the majority of the smokeless market. That's what tends to appeal to younger people, particularly males. They've come up with Camel Snus. Here's the kind of instructions they're giving. They're talking about use it anytime, anywhere. Again, really telling people they can use it in places where they're not allowed to light up a cigarette, can't smoke, pop a pouch, snus the new tobacco. You know, they've come up with products like the Orbs that sort of look like Tic Tacs and strips that look like Listerine breath refreshers, and that's the new dissolvable tobacco products that R.J. Reynolds introduced about a year ago, the sticks, the strips, and the Orbs. Then finally, we have the e-cigarette that's out there, which is the electronic nicotine atomizer. Please don't ever talk about this as a cigarette. All it is a nicotine nebulizer for a cigarette. Does it help people quit smoking? We don't know. So any claims that it does, we don't have the answer to that. The company should be required to provide data before they make claims. Unfortunately, that's not been required. And then secondarily, it's unlikely that this product will work. The data that I've seen on it, at least preliminarily, indicates that the amount of nicotine delivered into the body of the smoker with these devices is not very good. So if you want somebody to get withdrawal relief, they're better on the FDA-approved claim-tested, safety-tested nicotine delivery products, which are, you know, your patch, your gum, your lozenge, inhaler, and nasal sprays, not an e-cigarette. But it's a gimmick that's out there. I saw them in the shopping malls, too. And, you know, this is an area that I get asked about almost daily, and many of you probably do as well. How about talking to your patients? Here are a couple of conversation starters. I always start with what brand you smoke and why you smoke it and how much money you're spending and so on. If you want to know whether somebody's addicted, find out if they're a daily smoker, and then if you want to know what their level of addiction is, ask them if they light up within the first, you know, 5 or 10 minutes after they wake up in the morning. Those are the strongest indicators of nicotine dependence and probably tell you that they're going to need some extra hand-holding to be successful in quitting and probably would benefit from some of the medications. There are some great educational materials available through the Quit Line. Pat Bax is going to come on and tell you about some of those in a second. I just refer you to our website resource again, www.tobaccoproducts.org. And I'll open it up to questions at this point since we've got just a few minutes left to go. So I'll turn it back over to Liz, and you can begin to take questions and give some information on how people can offer their questions right now.
Most definitely. If you would like to ask a question, please press 0, then 1 on your telephone keypad. Okay, first in queue we have Sue Armanino. Sue, your line is open.
Hi, yes, I just have a quick question. Is it okay if we share this PowerPoint to Coalition members?
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, next in queue we have Roberto Hoffman. Roberto, your line is open.
Thank you, Dr. Cummings, for your call. I was wondering if you could speak about when you're training cessation counselors, how do you teach them to identify the most relevant motivator for a smoker?
Well, the most relevant motivator is health. I usually ask smokers, you know, why they smoke and why they wish they didn't. So on a personal basis, I'm trying to get at in an individual's motivation and so on, but the studies that we have done, and people will give you lots of reasons why they make quit attempts, but overwhelmingly and consistently over decades, it's always been about the health risks of smoking. So reinforcing those health risks and reinforcing the benefits of quitting in a more positive, gain-framed approach, in other words, trying to emphasize the benefits of not smoking and developing, you know, taking on a non-smoking lifestyle rather than always harping on the health risks, which you know, some of us have had a tendency to do because they're so overwhelming. It's hard not to talk about things and how devastating it is with lung cancer and heart disease. But I always go right to the health issues, and then I talk about money, a nickel to make it, what are you paying for a pack of cigarettes, and then for young people in particular, since nobody likes to be duped, I always ask, point out the fact that it's ironic that the heads of the cigarette company, major cigarette manufacturers in the United States today, don't use the product that they're selling.
Thank you.
Okay, next in queue we have Anne Marine. Anne, your line is open.
Yes, we were just looking at the 15 conversation starters, and we were curious about why are there 20 cigarettes in a pack, why not 15 or 44?
It's a day supply of nicotine for the typical smoker.
Oh, okay. Thanks.
So that's not my answer. That was you get that directly from William Dunn, who was probably a very good scientist, but he was the director of that human psychology program for Philip Morris for about 30 years.
Thank you.
Okay. Next in queue, we have Sharon Medrano. Sharon, your line is open.
Thank you. What would your advice be in regards to reaching pregnant women who may be smoking but not necessarily want to admit it?
Well, actually, I'm a fan, by the way, of doctors actually testing for nicotine, like dipsticks or doing CO testing when patients come in, so they can have a conversation starter with somebody who might be trying to hide their smoking. But I think, again, I'd emphasize the health risks of smoking to both the to their baby as well as to them, and the benefits to be accrued from quitting. And then, as a healthcare professional, I think you have to weigh the risks and benefits of some of the options that are available for somebody to quit. As I said before, I know there are contraindications for, using some of these medications, and that's true of almost all medications with somebody who's pregnant. But if they're smoking, the doctor has to weigh risks and benefits. And in other countries of the world, the United Kingdom for one, recently they've changed the rules about nicotine replacement therapy and encouraged pregnant women to consider that as an option to use for quitting if they're going to continue to smoke, even at a low level. So there's no such thing as a low level of risk from low-level smoking.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Next in queue, we have Harry Lewis. Harry, your line is open.
I have a question about people who use spit tobacco. Are there differences in using some kind of nicotine replacement therapy for people who are on spit tobacco as opposed to cigarettes?
Yes. Here's what I know of the literature. There have been a number of trials with nicotine gum and lozenge for people using, and even patches for spit tobacco. They've generally been negative results, in other words, no benefit. Their recent data has shown us that spit tobacco users, daily users of spit tobacco, benefit from 4 milligram, so a higher dose of nicotine. So it appears that the early studies that were, not very effective in showing the benefits of providing NRT to spit tobacco users to help them quit may have failed because they were underdosing the users. It's really important. There's huge variation in the amount of nicotine you get across different products. The highest end of the product is the Copenhagen product, and it's altered primarily by additives that alter the pH of the smoke, or the pH of the tobacco as it's absorbed through the lining of the mouth. And so some of the tea leaf, like Skull Bandits, it was unit dosing. They tend to be a little bit lower nicotine. And, in fact, the companies talk about a graduation schedule. The Bandits were primarily a starter product to wean young people into getting used to nicotine. Otherwise, they'd be throwing up when they first try it. And then to move them up the level to step up to Copenhagen. So I would spend a lot of time with spit tobacco users, find out not only how much they use, but pay attention to the brands, and then you can actually, there are some good studies out in the literature about the amount of nicotine you get in some of these different smokeless products.
And is there a preference for using, the lozenge or the gum or the patch for people who use spit tobacco?
Well, the one study I'm familiar with was a lozenge study with 4 milligram that had a benefit. It was a study by Herb Severson out of the University of Oregon. And so that's what I'm familiar with in what they tried. But I'm not sure. I think, like all the NRT products, I think it almost comes down to consumer preference. I think we do underdose those who are really addicted. And there's certainly evidence now with the updated practice guidelines that for particularly heavy smokers, and I think this probably applies as well for spit tobacco users, those who are really addicted and using a lot and constantly have the stuff essentially in their mouth, that they probably need to be getting maybe a combination of patch and the lozenge, patch and the gum. There's good literature now that those things work better than just the single monotherapy.
Thank you.
Okay, Dr. Cummings, this is Annie Beigel. I think we've got time for maybe one more question, and then I think we need to wrap up for today.
Okay.
Okay, our last question will come from Lamiel Jaron. Lamiel, your line is open.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Speak up.
I'm just a little curious about the rise of hookah bars. I'm wondering, since there's not a filter and there's not the paper as in cigarettes, has there been any research on the effects, the health effects? Or is it somewhat less dangerous, or would it be the same as smoking a cigarette?
I'm glad you mentioned that, because it is something that we do see, particularly around college campuses and so on, that has grown up, unfortunately, in some of our regions of New York State and around the country. It's dangerous. It's addictive. There is a literature out there. I'd be happy if anybody is interested in, you know, emailing me after this. I can certainly refer them to some of that literature that's out there. Here's the bottom line with the hookah. The biggest issue that we've seen, because, you know, non-smokers go into the hookah bars with their friends and so on, they get exposed to a pretty good dose of secondhand smoke in the air. This should be banned, by the way, so if they're burning tobacco, tobacco burning indoors is not legal. I know that a lot of the hookah bar places do the little bait and switch, and they pull out their herbal blends that's not tobacco. But even herbal blends, when you burn it, generates a lot of smoke in the air. Most of the secondhand smoke exposure, which can be pretty significant in these places, is generated by the coal that is used actually for heating the tobacco, for burning the tobacco. And so you get a lot higher levels of carbon monoxide in some coal byproducts, like sitting, you know, outside, you know, a smokestack that is generating heat as coal. There are hookah pipes that you can actually get, and there's some groups that are testing these that are electrically heated, which would actually eliminate the coal emissions that you get, which would probably be better both for the hookah smoker as well as for the non-smokers who are just, you know, sitting around. But the notion that you're not going to get addicted with hookah, people are addicted to hookah. Most of the good, you know, studies on the health effects have been done, obviously, in countries, particularly in the Middle East and in parts of India where hookah is, or shisha, as it's sometimes referred to, is widely used. And it can cause a lot of the same problems that you see with other combustion tobacco.
Okay. I want to thank you, Dr. Cummings. Pat Bax from the Quitline, what I think we can do now is I'll just toss the call over to you, and you can wrap up today's call. I want to thank you, Dr. Cummings. I want to thank the participants, and for the participants on the call today, please mark your calendars. Our next call will be on March 3rd, Tobacco Dependence, a Grand Rounds presentation. And let me turn it over to you, Pat, and you can wrap it up for today.
Thank you, Annie, and thank you, Dr. Cummings, for sharing your expertise and for providing helpful tools for our healthcare clinicians so that they can incorporate them into their cessation interventions. On behalf of our staff at the New York State Smokers Quitline, based here at Roswell Park Cancer Institute in Buffalo, a special thank you to you, our participants, for listening on this call, as well as to those who are unable to be with us today, for all your help in referring your patients and your clients to the Quitline in 2009. With your assistance, tobacco users all across the state received the free coaching and nicotine replacement therapy provided by the Quitline to help them become and remain tobacco-free. In a recent press release, our state health commissioner, Dr. Richard Dane, stated that we know quitting smoking isn't easy, but with expert help, smokers can surmount the difficulties. That expert help is the New York State Smokers Quitline. For those of you who are not familiar with our services, or if you have any specific questions, I invite you to visit and explore our website at www.nysmokefree.com, where you can find our educational resources, our fact sheets, including our most recent chronic disease fact sheets, our online NRT ordering, and materials for healthcare professionals. Stay tuned as we continue with our updates and reporting of our 2009 data. You can also call us and talk directly with one of our Quit coaches at 1-866-NY-QUITS. That's 1-866-697-8487. Quit Line is poised to be the resource you need to help your patients and clients quit tobacco use. And as we start this new year, we look forward to doing our part in creating a healthy and tobacco-free 2010. Thank you very much for being on this call, and Happy New Year to all of you.